Welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the UC Irvine campus and streaming live at kuci.org. Today's show is recorded on December 18th, 2020. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and today my guest is Ken Lane. Ken is the author of the new book, Desert Oracle, Strange True Tales from the American Southwest, Volume 1, published by FSG. He's also the creator of the quarterly journal, Desert Oracle, and host of the podcast radio show by the same name. Hey, Ken.
Good morning. Hello.
Great to have you. Great to have you on. I've been a fan, as you know, of the podcast since it began, and before that, a long reader of the journal. And maybe we could begin with actually how the Desert Oracle Journal came about.
Sure. I started the alleged quarterly in, well, the first issue was 2015. So I guess I started work on it in 14. So it's been about 6 years now. And the idea was to make a bioregional collection of folklore and the flora and fauna and work it into a conservation ethic, but to make it fun and weird and spooky like the desert is. It's not the same as the forest or a pond or something like that. It's nature sort of in its more weird, angry form.
And you were a reporter prior to starting the journal, yes?
I've been a reporter. Yeah, I've been a newspaper reporter, and I've worked in media one form or another my whole life. And as a new form breaks down or people abandon it or something else starts, like a lot of people in this field, I kind of jump onto another boxcar.
Yeah. Were you from the desert? Is that where your interest began, because you are from there? How did that happen?
I'm not. I'm born and raised in New Orleans, and I lived there until about middle school. And that was the first that I lived in the desert. My dad and his family grew up in Arizona. So when I was middle school age, we lived there for a couple of years, and that was my introduction, and I just loved it. I thought everything looked like a movie. It was like being in Lawrence of Arabia or Ten Commandments or something. Not day to day in the tract houses and the right developments and stuff, but Phoenix then and now just kind of builds right out to the wilderness. And where we were, it was basically one block away between the tract home Sunbelt suburbia and these giant saguaro and all kinds of reptiles and mountains. And so I just spent as much time out there as I could.
So I was, you know, in preparing for the interview this morning, I was trying to look things up about you, and I found an IMDb page. And I am curious, were you an actor, or do you also act? What is that about?
That is that the television credits?
Yeah, TV and movie.
Oh, I guess that's auto-generated, robotically generated content. No, I appear on some TV shows sometimes as a guest, and I assume that's what that is. I haven't been in any movies.
Yeah, it was interesting because there was sort of a shot that looked kind of like either a promo shot or something. And I'm like, oh, this is a whole other side. I don't know about this side.
I think that must be from some of the TV documentary stuff. There are often TV production companies coming out to the desert and looking for people to talk to, especially if they'll tell them a strange story.
Yeah. Well, you know, I wanted to ask you about that, about how, you know, with your coverage of the desert and the love you have for it, which is contagious, that you must have attracted a good number of people to the desert and maybe some who've taken up residence there. And I'm curious how you feel about that.
Oh, I don't think any population changes are associated with a little magazine and a podcast, but there are people who live here or who make it a pilgrimage once a year or certain seasons, and they like to connect with it when they're not here, and they like to make sense of it. And we don't have much in the way of, like many small towns, rural towns, local media. And if you do have local media, it's rarely about the place. It's just the radio station that you might have or the real estate listings paper or something. So by focusing on the stuff that everybody thinks about, if they enjoy the desert or if they love it, even though it kind of creeps them out, it makes kind of a network of people who are interested in those things. And I live in a very small town that's surrounded by national parks and public land. So happily, we're not going to have much of a population change here because the land is pretty much protected.
Well, you know, there's more I want to talk to you about that, but let's talk about the book. Let's talk about Desert Oracle Volume 1 and how the book came about. Did you begin with a book proposal or did FSG come looking for you? What happened?
What happened was Sean McDonald, who heads his imprint MCD Books for FSG, has been a subscriber for many years to Desert Oracle, to the print periodical. And last year I was facing kind of a economic challenge because I'd been in many ways kind of living off selling the back issues. I'm at 9 issues now. I'm working on the 10th issue. Mm-hmm. And people like to collect them. So as they discover the current issue or hear about it one way or another, hear about it through the radio show, they want to buy them. And once I began running out of back issues, I realized I had to either reprint them myself or find somebody to help. So I asked my friend Carolyn Kellogg, who used to be the mm-hmm. books editor at the Los Angeles Times sure. and still does a lot of work for them, and also a longtime desert property owner, although she's sadly not here anymore. I asked her if she knew anybody who might be interested in doing a collection, and she introduced me to Sean, and Sean had all the issues in his office in New York. So we started with a mutual understanding of what the thing was, and then it was just a matter of how to make it different while still reflecting the original periodical and what exactly to put in it. He was against making it just a, what he calls a bind up, just a bunch of mm-hmm. stuff from the back issues. And so it ended up being a mix of some of my longer pieces, mostly folkloric and historical pieces from the periodical. And then I wrote about 1/3 new stuff for it.
How did you decide what to leave out?
I was looking for a kind of campfire stories flow. Mm-hmm. I do these kind of ranger campfire stories, or I did before the pandemic. Hopefully I'll start doing them again next year sometime. And they're a great way to figure out what works for a selection of stories, because you got people looking you in the eye. and you can see if anybody's getting kind of bored or starts looking at their phone or something, and then you change course and give them something a little different. So that was the goal with the book. I like alternating between subjects that a lot of people don't think go together, but to me, they're all stories of the place. So you might have something that involves some history of a military base, followed by some Native American folklore and shamanistic practices. And then you might have stuff about transportation or pop culture, like movies filmed in the desert. And then interesting things that aren't too technical, because you don't want to be boring. You want things to have personality, as they do in the real world. So stories about the animals and the plants and the weird habits of our reptiles, etc.
This would be a great time to hear you read from Desert Oracle. Would you please?
I will.
All right.
I will read the introduction, which is surprisingly at the beginning of the book. Within these pages are many mysteries of the desert. Some are cruel and terrible, others sublime, and a persistent few remain inexplicable by our current metrics of understanding. Desert is wilderness stripped bare, and when left alone is creation and perfection. The landscape is vast and visible, the geology raw and exposed, the plants and animals in ideal proportion. Fresh water is generally in limited supply, but that has never stopped life from thriving in lands of little rain. Our own species has always been fond of these harsh and arid places. The first civilizations rose up from desert sands: Mesopotamia, ancient Egypt, the Indus Valley. The wilderness of antiquity was wild desert, and that's where our philosophers and prophets went to meditate on mountaintops, to abandon society for a while, and sleep under the stars or within limestone caves. There were many river valley civilizations in the North American desert too, before our current mess of outlet malls and cell towers and interstates. Ohokam and the Salt River Valley beneath modern Phoenix, the ancient Pueblo culture of the Four Corners, the Taos Pueblo is a rare unbroken link to those varied pasts. Despite the plastic letters on the gas stations and the same banal television programming beamed or streamed into every home, Taos is more or less as it was when Hernando de Alvarado arrived some five centuries ago, and as it had been centuries earlier, when the Roman Church was still struggling to Christianize the diverse peoples of Europe. Through a combination of accident and intent, much of the American desert remains mostly intact, mostly wild. The accident was in the claiming of so much American territory by the U.S. federal government in the mid-1800s. Actions taken to prevent competing claims and occupation by Spain, Mexico, France, England, Russia, all of our old imperial rivals. Places with surface water attracted settlers, despite the heat and the sandstorms and the scorpions, while the vast walls of mountains and expanses of dry lakes and valleys were spared much permanent development. This was followed by dramatic efforts to preserve and protect these desert ecosystems as national parks and monuments and federally designated wilderness. Actions inspired by the nature mystics of American transcendentalism. And that is from the very beginning of Desert Oracle, nice. Volume 1.
Very nice. That was Ken Lane reading from Desert Oracle. I love how the book looks. I like the size. I know you said you wanted it to be like the journal, and not much different. Did they come up with that, or did you go, can we do this and take it from there? How did you get the look of this thing?
I had a vision for the book that it was going to be a yellow cloth-bound hardback with no slip cover, And then I was going to have one color stamped printing, and that we'd use lots of the kind of old Victorian era desert illustrations of plants and animals and things like that. So that was the idea. And Sean at MCD suggested this trim size, so it was a little bigger as far as the height and width of the periodical, so that it would, it wouldn't be a shocking difference. It would still look like it was of a piece, but you definitely see from a distance book versus periodical. That was kind of the goal. And they had some great designers and artists and typesetters at FSG who got us to this final part. Fonts and lots of writers are kind of interested in words and punctuation and everything. And I am, as far as tools of the trade, but I love fonts. And I had very specific ideas about fonts, and they managed to stay true to those while making it different from the magazine. So my hope for it was that while it looks current, that it would also evoke this sense of finding some old kind of textbook or mining trails book or something like that in a used bookstore in the desert.
Mm. I love the photos as well and the illustrations. It's just such a nice package, you know?
Thank you. Yeah. The photos are mostly mine, and that's one of the things I love most, is just hiking around, driving around, and taking pictures that try to capture the mood, the loneliness, the kind of oddness and solitude of a place. And so I was very happy that they put in lots of illustrations. It's not a picture book, but it's more like if you pick up a book on desert wildlife or desert wildflowers or something. You have illustrations when necessary.
Right, when necessary. There's something here. I just saw a little snake illustration, and I've wondered, and I've been to the desert quite a bit. I've never lived out there, and I've never really spent a lot of time in a really kind of rustic or neighborhood where it's not planned. Let me say that. Do you have to like snakes to live in the desert?
You have to respect snakes. And you certainly have to be used to seeing them, because it's one of the most common forms of wildlife that you'll see day to day. And if you love hiking and walking, you'll get used to them. You'll get used to the seasons when they appear. I call it Snakesgiving, and it comes twice a year. Once when the snakes come out in the spring, and once when they go back in the fall, because they're not out in the winter. And so there are people who especially love the winter months, because you can be outside a lot more in the daytime. And also you can sort of range more casually, because you're not going to accidentally step on a rattlesnake. They don't bother anybody. People certainly kill a lot of them. But if you don't overreact or panic when you see a venomous snake, and most of the snakes you'll see are not. Most of the snakes you'll see are snakes you want around your house, because they control rodents, mm-hmm. Gopher snakes especially. But I know people who live in the desert who don't care for snakes, certainly. But most people who spend a lot of time outside learn to live and let live. And it makes everything nicer when you have the normal wildlife of the area just kind of around you, and you're all more or less used to each other.
Yeah. Ed Abbey, there's a few pieces in the book about Ed Abbey, and And I'm curious if he was an idol of yours, if you ever met him as a young adult. I think he died around 1989.
That's correct.
So yeah, let's talk about Ed Abbey for a minute.
Well, Edward Abbey, I think, made a effort to not become anybody's idol. He was a crank. He was a bit of a crackpot. He took great joy in his later years when he had become something of a icon in the environmental literature movement, of offending his audience, the sort of well-behaved college liberals. And he was that too. He would sometimes play as kind of a self-educated hick, but he had a doctorate in philosophy of all things, mm-hmm. and he had studied around the world, but he did not want anyone to call him an idol. But what I saw in Abbey as a kid was a kind of an example of a way you might be able to live your life if you could get all the pieces in place, because he didn't work for anybody. He seemed to live where he wanted to live. He had all these wild adventures, and magazines would pay him to go on these adventures, and then he'd collect them into books. And I thought, that's the way to do it. And I loved Desert Solitaire. That was the first mm-hmm. one I read when I was 17, right after my first kind of solo explorations of the American desert. And I did meet him, and we corresponded a little bit after that. He was very generous with the postcards and words of encouragement to, you know, young dumb kids who wanted the key to the universe from him. And he was very engaging and very funny. I saw him speak once at UCSD, one of his very rare lecture tours. I think it was for his book called Beyond the Wall, one of his later collections of nonfiction. And it was a full theater, and everybody was cheering, and it was a line of like 100 beautiful women and waiting to meet him. And it was, writers don't usually have lives like that. So I thought, wow, you know, what a life. Of course, most of the time he was sitting in a shack behind his nondescript house on the edge of Tucson. That's where he lived during the 80s, his last home, and working hard and never selling many books and always going after, you know, magazine publishers who weren't sending the checks.
Mm-hmm. I've read and loved Desert Solitaire and Monkey Wrench Gang. Are there others that you especially love of his books?
Desert Solitaire is one of those things that's usually people's way of being introduced to Edward Abbey. In the 70s, in the kind of like punk rock anarchist era of the 80s, Monkey Wrench Gang was also just a kind of a guide to a outlaw life, I guess, with purpose, with moral purpose. So even Abbey would admit that Desert Solitaire was the best. I think he really crystallized what he was doing there. He'd been writing for 20 years at that point. So it was new to most of the people who discovered him in the 70s with the paperback version. There's a couple other collections I'm fond of because I use them kind of as guidebooks to the Southwest. There's one called Abbey's Road. Mm-hmm. Which I enjoy a lot. Another one called The Journey Home that has a lot of my favorite pieces that he wrote. I'm also partial to a sort of science fiction dystopia novel that he did called Good News.
Mm. Okay. You know, speaking of fiction, you have a novel out as well, right? Dignity, is that a novel?
That is a novel, yes.
Tell me about that.
That's a weird one. that was more channeled than written. I knocked that out in about a month in kind of a trance, and it started off with these kind of dreams and waking visions that I was having for a while in the year before the book came out. I guess it was 2010, 11. And this was the aftermath of the housing collapse. And where I had lived when the housing collapse began, I was in the far western Mojave in the foothills of Phelan and Pinyon Hills. And from the foothills where I lived, especially where I'd walked the dog, I could see the huge development that broke Lehman Brothers. That was a straw that broke the camel's back in the housing collapse. And it was out there on the edge of Victorville. And for years afterwards, there were unfinished tract home communities all over the Sun Belt. They were in Phoenix, they were outside Palmdale, Lancaster, Victorville. And it was just an eerie thing because, much like now, so many people were losing their homes because of the collapse of the financial system, which only hurts people on the 90% of the bottom. And yet there were all these homes that had running water already. Their streets went to them. A lot of them weren't finished. A lot of them were just studs. They would have the roof and the studs and the openings for the doors. And I thought, boy, people just ought to go out there and take those things over, all this good housing and the fresh air, and make it work. And I wrote the book as a sort of fantasy about people pushed out of their jobs and their homes in the city as the chaos, as the collapse of America accelerated, and going out and kind of doing a back to the land, but a real low budget back to the land, where you're kind of like a hermit crab. You just find another shell to move into and fix it up. And so I was under contract at the time for another book, a nonfiction book on the California coast through Harper Studio, which closed during the recession, but I was still under contract. So I made a little publishing company to put it out. And that was sort of how I learned what to do. And I used all those lessons, or what not to do, for Desert Oracle, for the periodical. And then the book came out in May. It got some notices. I got a couple of reviews, which is good. It's hard to do that at all. But it was just something I wanted to get out of my head, because it was kind of driving me nuts. And then in September, I start seeing everywhere online these pictures of these scenes in New York and in Manhattan around this little corporate concrete park, Zuccotti Park. It was Occupy Wall Street. And these were the scenes I'd been seeing and dreaming of in the 6-12 months previous. And I thought, that's crazy. I thought that was in Los Angeles, but that I lived around Los Angeles at the time. And so I went out there and spent a couple of weeks hanging around Occupy Wall Street. And everybody I talked to, it was the same thing. Like, oh yeah, I'd had visions of this. As soon as I saw it, I had to come. So that's what was behind that.
That's interesting. Okay. I'm going to have to read that on my list. Good. But
it's,
you know,
it's a book of letters. It's all written as letters. Huh. You know, it was sort of like the epistles and the New Testament, these far-flung, abandoned tract home communities with people kind of hiding out and communicating by letters.
How did that form? How did that structure come to you?
Because I heard the voice of the primary narrator, who's mostly writing letters to these little communities, like Paul going from community to community in the Eastern Empire, going and kind of seeding something and then writing them letters of encouragement and kind of a little discipline. So that was it just took the form very naturally. For a while I was fighting it. It's like, I gotta have narrative and et cetera, but it worked much better just to let the letters tell the story.
You know, you have some really interesting stories that I find unexplainable, and I think it seems you do too. And one of them is one I heard you tell, might have been last week. You were on Alta, I think it was last week, and you told a story about being on a road in the desert in the middle of the night and no cars around, and suddenly there's this light as if, you know, this cruiser, something comes up right behind you. You stop and it goes in reverse so fast that it was, you know, what was it, right? Will you tell that story again? And do you have a lot of these experiences out there? Is this just something that happens in the desert? Or is it?
Well, I don't know if it happens to everybody. It doesn't happen if you're at the golf club in Palm Springs, but if you're there's a phrase that Yeats has in the Celtic Twilight about the kind of last remnants of the old fairy and pagan beliefs of Ireland, and he says that if you get out into the quiet and you make yourself quiet so that your soul and your mind is like a still pond, then the spirits and the entities that are around us can be drawn to you so that they can see themselves reflected in that still pond. Mm. And I think that's very much what has always drawn mystics and prophets to the desert, is the sense of nature stripped down so that you can turn off your mind from all the chitter chatter and sit up on a mountaintop or on the desert spring or on a lonesome highway at night, and these energies, whatever they are, will be drawn to you if you're quiet enough to receive them. So the case in the story you're talking about happened on Amboy Road between the little town of Amboy and Roy's and the Mojave Trails National Preserve and Wonder Valley, which is the far eastern edge of the Morongo Basin, the area that so many tourists come to now to see Joshua Tree, Yucca Valley, the national park. And I was coming back from looking at wildflowers. It was a super bloom. And I drove back to Joshua Tree. It's a couple hours. You know, I love driving on desert back roads at night. So it was late. I don't know exactly what time, but it was probably midnight-ish. And there was nobody on the road. It was a weeknight. And as I'm coming up the grade south on Amboy Road past the dry lake beds, I see what appears to be like headlights behind me on the road, and they're going real fast. So my first thought is CHP. They sometimes roam around there because that road is used as the back way to Vegas for people in Palm Springs and also for people where I live. But it was going so fast that I got a little sense of, you know, it's some maniac who's just going to like drive into me or pass me with a bunch of drama, you know, like a 19-year-old and a Dodge Charger or something. So the lights get right up behind me, so they're just blinding me in my rear view and my side mirrors. and don't pass me. And I'm doing, I'd slow down to 58, 60, something like that, you know, plausible deniability in a 55 zone. And I'm not thinking of anything weird or paranormal or anything. I'm just thinking an annoying person on the road who is going to come bother me and I'm not doing anything. So I just slowed down to the point where I kind of coasted to a stop in the middle of the road going uphill. So I slowed down pretty quickly, thinking, hoping that the jackass would pass me and go on up the hill. Instead, it just sits there. So I finally turn around to get a sense of what's going on. And it's just these two blinding lights, and they retreat. And they retreat at just an impossibly fast speed. I looked it up later on the maps online, and that grade's about 14 miles long. And it just zipped down that grade in a flash, a few seconds. Got down to the bottom where the dry lake bed is, and they just turned off like a light switch. And it's, I first thought, I don't know, should I drive back down there and yell at the teenagers or something? And I finally just shrugged and was like, whatever. They had their fun. I'm going to drive on home. And it was somewhere through Wonder Valley when it occurred to me that I never saw a car.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, once I got home and realized the distance that it just disappeared down this huge grade in a few seconds, that's impossible. So then I kind of got the, you know, hair standing back on the neck, up on the back of the neck. And I thought, what was that? So I start searching around because I have all these places I go to look for stories, for folklore, for experiences people have. And I found a number of incidents like that on Southern California back roads.
Hmm.
I found one on a UFO reporting site because the guy said, I don't know where else to report this. It wasn't flying, it was driving. I guess it was a UDO. It was a ground level. And there were a couple of things like this here and there. And I guess the weirdest thing about that is it just struck me as annoying at the moment. And then later I got the sense of, oh, whatever that was playing, you know, playing with me like a cat with a mouse.
And it's interesting that you stopped, and, you know, the lack of fear I find really interesting. I'm not sure what I would have done. I don't think I would have stopped, but that's interesting.
I always stop and jump out whenever there's something strange, you know, or just novel in whatever way, whether you see some odd bird behavior or you see some desert bighorn way up on a mountain far away from you, you know, get out the binoculars. I've never heard of anyone being hurt by weird lights in the mm-hmm. sky, so mm-hmm. I guess I embrace the opportunity to get up close to something bizarre, because it's not the kind of thing, again, that's going to happen when you're in line at Starbucks or something. It happens when you're out in the middle of nowhere and it's just for you. You know, there's no point even in telling anyone, because unless it's a collection of strange stories about the desert, because you have nothing to back it up. It's just an anecdote.
Right. Well, on the Desert Oracle podcast and in the journal and now in the book, there are stories about space aliens. I mean, and this seems to, the desert is always the place where, you know, you hear about things appearing in the sky or, you know, people seeing things. What about that? I mean, Area 51 is out there.
Yeah, Area 51 is the easternmost edge of Edwards Air Force Base. It's an auxiliary airfield, Groom Lake. And there's a supersonic corridor for the testing of new aerospace wonders that go between Edwards and Groom Lake. So sometimes people see things and you're seeing a plane that hasn't come out yet. Like in the 1980s, there were a number of reports around Nevada and the Mojave Desert of kind of a batwing craft. And at least some of those can be attributed to the stealth bomber once it officially made its debut. Likewise, in the 50s, a lot of the high altitude stuff, because there weren't really extremely high altitude aircraft known at the time, a lot of the high altitude shining things that people would see way up in the sky over Vegas, when Vegas was first growing out from its hotel casino strip, those would be the U-2 or the Blackbird, and those were being tested out of Area 51. The stranger things are consistent with folklore all around the world way before the Industrial Revolution. The fairies, the fair folk, the good neighbors, the demons, the dwarves, the strange shapes of light that they would retreat into or come out of, the hypnotic nature of the encounters with these things. People would forget the details, people would lose time, as in the old Irish stories, you know, some old man would be walking home and he'd hear the fairies singing, and then the family would go looking for him and find him a day later by himself in a field, dancing around ecstatically, convinced he was surrounded by the little people. So those things, I think, are ancient things. And especially in the 20th and 21st century, our first inclination is to try to explain everything away, even if the explanation is as, you know, dubious as the folkloric tales that came long before us. So people see some lights in the sky. They know that we are taking our first baby steps as space travelers and space explorers. So maybe that's what's going on. Maybe it's somebody else from some other spacefaring civilization. But I think we just fit these things into whatever our cultural context is. So apparitions that you'd have today that somebody would say, oh, it's aliens, 100 years ago, say in a Catholic country like Portugal, where the miracle of the sun at Fatima was, would say it's Mother Mary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting stuff. I mean, there's so much I want to talk to you about regarding this book, and we have a few minutes left. So one of those things was a couple of pieces about people disappearing in the desert. And I'm always curious when that happens. And I wonder, is it people underestimate the water they need to stay alive? Is it easy to get lost out there because there are no markers that are different enough that you can, you know, trace your path? What is it?
The people who get lost and who perish in the wilderness tend to be casual tourists. And a good example of that is a lot of these places, say Amboy Crater, which is about an hour up from the Joshua Tree area. It's a beautiful old cinder cone that you can walk up, and it's just a sandy trail. There's not much to it. But if you start in the morning, even if it's spring, if it's not, or fall, if it's not the really hot seasons, you tend to think the weather's mild. This is not outside of my usual experience. I'll just go walk and I'll come back. And then suddenly it's 100 degrees and the sun is beating down and the ground is hot and the rocks are hot. and you don't have a cell signal, so you can't check your maps program to lead you back to your car in the parking lot, which might only be a half mile away. And then you start suffering from exposure. So the exposure is a combination of the incredibly harsh sun, the conditions you're not used to, the very low humidity. Maybe you brought water. Sometimes when people are found dead, they've still got water. So it's too late when they realize they're in trouble. You start, and this has happened to me. I mean, this happened to every desert hiker ever. You do something when it's too hot and you get to a point where, oh, I'm feeling kind of cloudy, you know, I'm feeling kind of dumb. And at that first sign, of course, that's when you find some shade if you can and wait it out until you feel better. Or if you know you're close to where you've come from, that's the time to go back. Don't keep going and think, ah, it'll be all right, I'm adjusting. So that is a lot of it. Sometimes these places where people disappear, and this has happened a few times in different homes I've had in this area, the place where people disappear is just kind of the backyard, so to speak, of the people in the area who are wandering around at that same time, walking their dogs, taking pictures of birds or whatever, and without any equipment, any water. Of course, they know where they are. They do it every day. You can walk a mile and walk back, and there's no need to go out with a bunch of survival equipment. But if you don't know where you are, you're not comfortable with it, and you're used to being able to look at that phone and get help, that's when people get into trouble.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I would imagine that not everywhere out in the desert offers a signal for your phone.
It's getting better. I mean, worse for as far as I see it. I love being able to be in a place where you can't be bothered. Mm-hmm. And there are fewer and fewer places on Earth where you can have that experience. So I've definitely got places I go on purpose for walking the dog, taking a walk by myself, whatever the case, because I know there's no service and I'm not going to get bugged for an hour or two. For an hour or two, I can live like a human.
Well, because this is volume one, is volume two underway?
It's only underway in the sense that I'm always writing and making new magazines, and I write the radio show every week. It's a script, you know, other than interviews. So there's material that's being done all the time, and I've got a lot more material than I can use in a 44-page periodical, and I like that size. So I want to keep the periodical that size, and I also have some pieces that aren't by me in the periodical. I like to get people with some expertise. For instance, I had a story in the current issue. A friend of mine up in Boulder City who is a professional eagle nest watcher. So he travels around for this biological organization, and he goes into the wilderness and counts eagle nests, climbs up on mountains, uses a scope. Are there eggs? Are there hatchlings? And I just love that kind of stuff, because this, you read that and it's romantic, you know, it's mm-hmm. like, to me, that's a lot more romantic than old cowboy stories about going around shooting people. So I've got a lot of stuff. I would like to do more volumes. The publisher came up with the volume one thing, so I will take that as a vote of encouragement for more, assuming, you know, this one sells enough to satisfy corporate, to whoever actually runs a publishing company, and you never know that.
Well, it's getting a lot of good press. I'm happy to see that, really.
Thank you. Yeah, I have too. I think, you know, writers are humans, and they like to, it's a fun story for writers, because you get to imagine, what if I did that? You know, mm-hmm. What if I quit this cushy job at the Wall Street Journal, or not that there are a lot of cushy journalism jobs left, but mm-hmm. you know, jobs where you might get health care and you're working from home, like a lot of office desk workers at this point. You know, what if I just chucked it all and went out to wherever, my favorite place, and did some little specialty thing? And I mean, I hope more people do that. It'd be fun to have stuff like Desert Oracle wherever you went. You know, go to the Deep South and have a little journal of like weird folklore and the animals and history, etc. Or really any place. You know, any place has spirits of place, and any place, if you connect with it, it makes your life much richer, because you're not just a consumer. You know, you have a place and a community, and you have a place in the part of the world where you live.
Yeah. Well, along those lines, and in closing, do you have any advice or words of wisdom for the writers listening?
You have to make your own fate. I think that's the only lesson from the stuff I do, because my working career has been as normal as a lot of other people who, you know, I've been doing this for 40 years, and it was afternoon newspapers when I first started working on newspapers, printed on paper. I've done magazines, websites, radio, and the stuff is always changing. And we, the humans, we're the first thing they dispose of when they decide it's not making enough money for the back office. So it's much less settled and safe to kind of chop your way through the woods, but at least you're not going to wake up and get an email saying thank you for your service. You know, you get 2 weeks severance.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great advice. I like that. Make your own fate. Ken, thank you so much for being on the show.
Barbara, thank you for having me. And we have a book that we worked on that's coming out soon.
That's right. Palm Springs Noir. I can't wait. I guess July 2021. It's on Amazon, on other platforms as well.
And fantastic.
The audio rights were bought just recently, I heard. So, but not by Amazon, by a platform called Scribd, which I think is more in keeping with independent publishers.
And, very cool.
Yeah, so it's very cool. So that'll be next year. That'll be fun to do that.
And I think we might get to have an in-person book party by then, maybe.
Wouldn't that be nice? Well, thank you so much. And I'll be talking with you soon.
All right. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. You have been listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI FM. My guest was Ken Lane. His book is Desert Oracle. You can find Ken online, here and there. You can subscribe to his journal, which I need to do. I need to resubscribe. My subscription has lapsed. And all you writers out there, like you said, create your own fate and stay in the chair or standing before a standing desk, if that's what you do. We'll be right here next week. Thanks for listening.
your heart be like next year? All our troubles will be out of sight. Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Make the Yuletide gay. Next year all our troubles will be miles away. Once again, as in olden days, happy golden days of yore. Faithful friends who are dear to us will be near to us once more. Someday soon we all will be together. If the fates allow, until then we'll have to muddle through somehow. So have yourself a merry little Christmas now. In olden days, happy golden days of yore. Faithful friends who are dear to us will be near to us once more. Someday soon we all will be together. If the fates allow, hang a shining star upon the highest bough. A merry little Christmas now. And have yourself a merry little Christmas now. Chestnuts roasting on an open fire, Jack Frost nipping at your nose, Yuletide carols being sung by a choir, and folks dressed up like Eskimos. Everybody knows a turkey and some mistletoe help to make the season bright. Tiny tots with their eyes all aglow will find it hard to sleep tonight.